All right, welcome to the Footy Museum and the Footy Museum Podcast. I am Justin Whitty. I am the co-director of said Footy Museum, and I am joined by Maria Van Dyken Lee, who is also a co-director of this here Footy Museum. And today, we are excited to continue our series, our tome, our masterwork, our historically significant look into the history of soccer here in Chicago. Are you excited?
I'm so excited.
So we started this talking from kind of the end of the 19th century up to basically the World's Fair. So we're going to pick up around then, but really go from 1900 to 1930. And there's a lot that happens in that period. Since we're trying to get a sense of the overall picture, we're going to kind of tell this period in time through just a handful of stories.
Yeah.
So if you're like, oh, you didn't mention so-and-so. Well, I'm sorry. We had to.
We only have so much time.
Yeah.
What do you want from us? do you want to sponsor this podcast?
Yeah. We will do an 18-hour segment just on these 30 years if you sponsor this podcast. All right. But I think that the important place to start would be with a key individual, Maria. And who is that individual?
That individual is a Mr. Peter J. Peel, the father, basically, of Chicago soccer. As we discussed in part one of our Chicago soccer history, just as soccer's popularity began to grow, corresponding with the 1893 World Columbian Exposition.
Oh, that's so much fun there.
Me too. Effects of the economic downtime and the Spanish-American War caused the popularity of soccer to shrink just as quickly. The game continued without an organized league, thanks to teams like the Hyde Park Blues and the Wanderers, who we talked about in our last pod, but the future was uncertain. However, it was that same World's Fair that lured one of the most pivotal figures in U.S. soccer history.
Who could it be?
To the city. Hold on, hold your horses. And to make Chicago his home.
Oh.
His name?
Yeah.
Was Peter J. Peel.
Oh, I'm so relieved because that's who the slide is of. If it was someone else, I would have been very.
Yeah, I'm relieved too because we didn't discuss the slides and the intros for this section at all.
Oh boy.
So it's nice that that lined up.
Yeah.
Peter Peel was originally from Dublin and he was just 27 years old when he came to the fair in Chicago. And like hundreds of thousands of other visitors, he decided to stay. The reason why is not clear, but it is clear that he loved football.
I think it was the corn dogs.
Loved it.
Yeah.
Peel remained a consistent presence in the Chicago soccer scene and in 1909 donated the Peel Cup. Ever heard of it?
The Peel Cup. Basically the championship of Chicago for many years.
His vision was for that cup to grow into an open Midwest competition, but instead it did become the de facto championship of the city. Peel was instrumental in revitalizing the league structure, played a key role in both the birth of the USFA and the ISSA, and was involved with pretty much all things football-related in the Windy City at the start of the
United States Football Association and the Illinois State Soccer Association.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, yeah.
So he kind of had his hands in everything.
He really did.
Yeah. He kind of unpeeled the sport in Chicago.
That's what they
exposing
say.
Exposing the fruit of its beauty to all the residents.
Got straight to the pit.
Straight to the pit. So, Peter J. I love the idea that he came to Chicago to go to the World's Fair. And as you recall, there was potentially going to be this World Cup style international soccer tournament. I like to think, and somewhere out there, someone knows the answer, but I like to think he came to go see that and was like, like the best jilted customer, like the biggest Karens in the world. He was so mad, or Kens, sorry, Karens or Kens. He was so mad that he's like, you know what? You're not going to have that tournament? Then I'm just going to completely create soccer in the city. And so it was just done out of spite, maybe? No.
I like that. I like that story. A spite soccer takeover.
Whatever the reason, if it wasn't for him, you could argue that none of the history, even of U.S. soccer, may have happened the same way.
That is true.
Here we see Peter J. Peel, different stages of life, and the glorious Peel Cup. The Peel Cup awarded most of its career to like the top team in Chicago. You did mention it originally was supposed to be a kind of a Midwest league. What happened to the Peel Cup? Is it still, are people still playing for it today?
You may have noticed that people, this would have been the one of the oldest soccer trophies, tournaments in the country, older than the U.S. Open Cup, right?
Which means MLS would have hated the Peel Cup too.
Yeah, MLS totally would have hated the Peel Cup. Somebody, little team known as Chicago Olympic, went ahead and lost a 3-foot-tall trophy one year after like 61 and this years.
1970, right?
I think so.
70 or 71, yeah.
So it was about 60 years of continuous championships. Oh. The constant, like the cup of Chicago, like the biggest, each league had their own cup, but this was the one people wanted. They went ahead and they lost it.
Well, I think what's more suspicious is that after the Chicago Olympic, that's the name of the team, won and it disappeared, the president of Chicago Olympic was seen in public with a giant silver vanity necklace.
Is that true?
That just said Olympic boss. And he never explained where he got that silver. That's a lot of silver.
And he had grills on his teeth.
And he had grills on teeth, like king of Chicago. Wow. Those early years when there were so many different leagues and changes, him kind of solidifying into one structure with four tiers.
He created the Chicago Pyramid, right?
Yeah, the Chicago Pyramid. But also he carried the league through some really difficult times. Famously, World War I, right? So this was a lot of players, even before the U.S. entered the war, were signing up with their native countries or with Canada and the effect on the economy. And Peel was behind a lot of initiatives to raise money for the war. And that generosity, we should also mention, is tied into the Peel Cup also,
which
because
the
proceeds
cup,
from that would go to injured players. So he was really involved. And one of my favorite things he did during the World War One period is he started a program called Teach the Kaiser How to Play Football. And this was to raise money for the war effort against the Kaiser. But
it sounds like a nice thing to do.
So pleasant. Like, maybe he should just learn how to play. Just to play a sport.
We'll be fine. Just to teach the Kaiser how to play.
Maybe he doesn't know the proper rules of association football. And then also a great story from this period is shortly after the war, 1919, there were a lot of U.S. soldiers stationed in the Great Lakes area who weren't from the area. And he organized a tournament of kind of all-stars from outside players with Chicago all-stars. And he held it inside the one. It was an indoor tournament held inside of, what do you call that? The pens,
Barn.
The barn of a livestock convention, because Chicago was like, you know, slaughterhouse city. So imagine like sawdust on the ground.
Yeah.
You imagine
so
the smell.
Smelly.
Oh, so great.
Be like playing inside the pens at like the Minneapolis or the Minnesota State Fair, which is my only reference for a barn that large.
Oh my God. And I hope that just for consistency's sake, they played with inflated pig bladders in that game.
Yeah.
That'd be great.
Farm to table.
The structure that he built, you start to get really important teams that push the game forward in the city. A lot of those teams were really represented through the Peel Cup, the winners of that. So this is the winners of the Peel Cup from 1910 to 1929. So kind of that period we're talking about. And you see a lot of repeat names. Now there are the odd Hyde Park Blues, which we've mentioned a lot, Harvey, Joliet. But mostly you're seeing Pullman, the Bricklayers, and a team called Chicago Sparta. And we're going to talk a little bit more in depth about those because they help describe a lot of what was going on in the city and in the sport at that time. And we should probably start with our good old friends from Pullman.
Pullman. What's been going on with Pullman? Mm. Let's see. So we introduced Pullman, Carco, and the Pullman / Thistles team in the last episode where we talked about Chicago history. Their dominance continued as soccer revitalized in the next decades. And in 1916, they made it all the way to the semifinals of the third ever Challenge Cup, now known
as the U.S. Open
Cup. The U.S. Open Cup.
Now known as the Lionel Messi MLS Junior Cup.
Ever heard of it? My goodness. They played the very famous Bethlehem Steel in a home and away series. This was the first time a major Eastern team had ever visited Chicago. And like we said, East and West, big rivalry. So the Pullman Car Company marked the occasion by sending their own custom passenger cars, very fancy, to go pick up those players.
Do you think they were really fancy or like subversive? Like the seat was like rock hard and like they took the shocks out of it. And they're like, oh, yeah.
Yeah, have a good night's sleep.
Have a good night's sleep.
Safe travels. The first leg played at Pullman Park went to double overtime, ending in a tie. And Pullman went on to lose.
Double time, that's two overtimes. Just a little soccer fact for our
listeners. Didn't know that. Thank you for teaching me something. So Pullman went on to lose the second leg in Pennsylvania. And unfortunately for Pullman, the series was the peak of their national success. Mm. The team folded the following year.
That's crazy.
I know. But it was probably due to complications brought on by World War I, which affected both individual players and American industry as a whole.
And as we know, would not have happened if someone had taught the Kaiser
how to play football. If the Kaiser had only known how to play football. Plus, the overall dynamics of the city shifted during this time. And while Pullman did reorganize 3 years later in 1920, the team never again rose to the level of the 1916 season. So they were still good locally, but they never quite got to that next level again.
And you could see from the Peel Cup, there were still presence in the city for sure, because their name is on that 20-year period more than any other. But part of it was with the interest of the company itself changing. They weren't willing to pay for the players to travel.
Yeah.
And they were looking at it, more emphasizing it back as a workers' community building project versus actually building a team, which makes sense. That's how it started.
Their priorities had to shift a bit with the changing times, but that was a trend all across the board, pretty much.
But we mentioned in the first ever association football match in Chicago, which Pullman was part of, that game was played on a field that has been removed and is now where the highway cuts along Pullman. But they, like the other teams you mentioned, were required to build stadiums. And they had Pullman Park, which was also a pretty big stadium in the city. I'm amazed at how many of these stadiums used to be all over Chicago.
I know. It's kind of crazy. Like, you see baseball fields a dime a dozen nowadays, but it was just that, but soccer.
And not just, like, to play, but, like, you know, like, pretty much professional level. Well, probably on par with what baseball stadiums were at that time.
Thousands of spectators, too.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And that's not a history people in the city know at all. I think when they talk about building new soccer stadiums now, it seems like, oh, well, that's something new. Or when they talk about the potential of the Fire maybe moving to where the White Sox were. There's no awareness that there was been multiple soccer fields there.
Yeah,
stadiums.
It was a cricket field, and then it was a soccer field, and then it was a baseball field.
And what we're looking at here is where Pullman Park was. So this is, again, in Pullman, now part of Chicago, South Side, and it is the location of the high school. And you see how it would have been just right in the community there. When we think park, they're big, but they are a little different. So you mentioned that the Pullman kind of peak was when they made the semifinal of what we call the U.S. Open Cup, the Challenge Cup. This is a photo from that National Challenge Cup final that included Bethlehem Steel. And I would like to highlight the grandstand on the left, very like old Wrigley Field. But
I have nightmares.
I'm not sure that this was inspected to have 600 people on the roof. It wasn't just the shift in the Pullman company's priorities that kind of changed their role in the city. It was also kind of the shift in the city itself, where the power was shifting somewhat from a paternal factories and companies and towards newly formed unions and workers groups.
So it was the progressive era.
Yeah, and that really falls into the rise of the next kind of big team of the era, and that is the Bricklayers and Masons Football Club of Chicago. The Bricklayers, the Brickies, the Mortar Slingers.
The Trowel Wielders.
The Trowel Wielders.
That's a mouthful.
Trowel Wielders. Trowel. There we go. When I say sling, you say mortar. Sling.
Mortar.
Sling.
Mortar. When I say trowel, you say wielders. Trowel.
Wielders.
Trowel.
Wielders. Oh, man. I just get a sense of what it was like at Bricklayers Park.
I can feel the history in this
room. Oh, my gosh. Tell us a little bit. Remind us of the Bricklayers.
So the Bricklayers and Masons FC was a union team founded by the Union Local 21. Their popularity and growth echoed that of the labor movement in the city. Mm-hmm. And playing at the fairly modern Bricklayers Park with a fairly great brickwork, from what I'm told.
Yeah. Free labor. That might be in the background in this picture on the left. That's just a guess. Yeah.
It was built right alongside Comiskey, a White Sox stadium.
Yeah.
White Stockings, actually. The Bricklayers had a loyal and boisterous fan following. Mm. While Pullman had now been reduced to a regional force, the Bricklayers made their regular appearances on the national scene, making the Challenge Cup final in 28 and 31. No doubt they would have continued their success if not for the effects of the Great Depression.
Mm, I've heard of it.
Risks they took that didn't quite pay off.
Now, would the Great Depression probably could have been dealt with more sleep and a proper diet?
And exercise. And exercise. But they were exercising.
And meditation.
Maybe they were exercising too much.
Yeah. Maybe. Hmm. I don't know. I'm no historian. I'm just throwing that out there. But here you see, yes, that's true. Alongside Comiskey, which is no longer there, is it called Guaranteed Rate Field or something like that, where the White Sox play, was one of the leading stadiums in the city, Bricklayers Park. As you said, there's beautiful masonry entryway, entryway, and such a historic location. Obviously, originally the site of the Chicago Wanderers.
That's just the kind of thing you wish was preserved.
Yeah. I want to know when exactly it tore. My guess is it was torn down for parking lots. Or at least some, it would be nice if some part of it was preserved.
Yeah.
But that's so true of so much of this history. Now, you said they had boisterous fans.
Mm-hmm.
Do you have any examples of what that might be?
Well, so there was a match against Chicago-Vienna, in which fan violence broke out. Two people were stabbed by Bricklayers fans. And this was at a...
Were they stabbed with trowels?
Yes, they were, which resulted in a trowel ban.
That's why to this day you can't bring trowels.
At this time, they were actually going under the name the Wiebold Fonderers because they had a sponsorship from a department store.
Yeah.
That lasted a couple of years. They're still Bricklayers in their hearts.
In their hearts.
Trowelers, those brickies.
Yeah.
So
that fan was stabbing as a Bricklayer.
Two people were stabbed, and this is not the only time that violence like this broke out, but this was kind of one of the defining moments that kind of actually led maybe to the downfall of the team, because they ended up losing that sponsorship and then weren't quite able to sustain after that.
So maybe it's the reputation.
Yeah. The department store sponsor pulled out, because trowel stabbings are not a good look.
It's not. It's not.
But that was just one instance of violence. There were actually, between them and Sparta, which we'll get to, there were also several riots that occurred.
And this is where the famous football term to be trowel stabbed comes from. Mm-hmm. When a player flounders around on the field as if fouled, it's like there's an apparent trowel stabbing. You may have heard that, especially our English listeners.
Yeah. they're just slinging mortar out there on the field.
That wasn't the only game or team that had some of these kind of intense clashes. And a lot of those came from teams that were based out of immigrant groups, right? You had very proud and strong communities all over Chicago from different ethnic backgrounds that started teams, and they had a lot of tension. And we're looking at a picture here of North Avenue in Humboldt Park, which was actually a Danish neighborhood. Chicago at one point had the second largest population of Danes, Swedish, Norwegians, Romanians, Germans in world all at the same time. And
you can't get a Cunning Bullar anywhere in this town.
No, well, not anymore. I mean, everybody left. And that, I like that because it kind of ties in with the imagined history of our museum as well. Because if you look at like the DeVos Pure Drugstore, it reminds me of Kip and Casper's Grocery.
Mm-hmm.
But this brings us to the next team that really kind of picked up in that absence of Pullman and the Bricklayers. You want to talk to us about Sparta?
Yeah, Sparta. Sparta, the next in the dynasties.
Yes.
Pullman to Bricklayers to Sparta.
Chicago soccer dynasty.
So company teams, union teams, and athletic association sponsored teams had all had their moments during the early period of the century.
Mm-hmm.
But going into the middle part of the century, the most dominant Chicago club grew out of an ethnic club from the diverse and influential International Soccer League,
mm-hmm.
or ISL.
Yeah. Yep.
So Sparta FC.
Or Issel.
Issel. I'm sure they appreciate that.
Yes.
Sparta FC, initially a Czech team, played at 26th and Kostner.
And not far from where we are right now.
Not at all. Sought national success from its beginning. So they were determined. A tough side with even tougher fans, the club burst onto the league, surprising many. They instituted several professional practices, including hardcore training methods and aggressively recruited players, which people didn't like how aggressive they were with that.
Yeah.
So Sparta players, along with the best of the bricklayers, took part in the growing trend of international friendlies. Sparta and Bricklayers All-Stars participated in 18 international friendlies between 1926 and 29. Their opponents included teams such as Glasgow Rangers and,
the Rangers
and Uruguay's national team.
And they played potentially at the Kostner Avenue Stadium?
That's crazy, yes, which was Sparta Stadium was known as one of the best in the city. I think actually a lot of finals and important games were played there, even if Sparta wasn't playing in them.
And this is where it, what it looks like.
The gorgeous.
No.
The gorgeous Sparta Stadium.
For soccer football fans out there, Rangers, a historically known team, and Nacional traveled to Chicago and played here. And there's no marker or anything of it.
No.
But you have found this.
I found this aerial photo that may or may not have been taken by a pigeon.
Now, you mean a camera strapped to a pigeon. The pigeon wasn't like... pushing the button.
It was probably more likely a hot air balloon or something.
Just one more.
Let's help. Have you ever seen a pigeon soar? It's actually quite majestic.
Oh, wow.
Anyways, this is, yeah.
Single tier.
Okay. This is the historic scene. And this is from 1938. So that's pretty cool.
Yeah. And you can see the enclosed field, the irregular shape. Looks like maybe it was originally a baseball field because it also has a grandstand that's kind of in the corner of
or
the park.
Or a cricket or something,
or cricket.
Maybe potentially.
But you also get a sense of like, this is from a space pigeon in the 30s and then the field lines are pretty established.
Yeah, so you can like, see the lines. They really lay down that paint, toxic lead paint.
But yeah, I think the big difference when I read about them, and Sparta, it's unclear, but I think they're still in some...
I can't figure. I think
they were for a long time. They might be some club still in the city. So please let us know. Their web presence is minimal or non-existent.
Get online, Sparta, wherever
so
you
there,
are.
There is some version out there still of the side, but nowhere near the kind of national and international fame. Because they actually even later in their career organized a tour of Mexico.
Yeah, they were like the first U.S. team to go to Mexico. I think these were like the first real Mexican U.S.
Yeah, so like the biggest rivalry in U.S. soccer is against Mexico. And the first kind of international Mexican U.S. matches were Sparta traveling in Mexico.
They played in Mexico before the U.S. national team ever played Mexico.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And to think about Rangers coming to the stadium, I would have loved to seen what it was like down at that time. And again, points
but
to how many
wear
these
your body
are.
Armor and watch out for those guys with trowels.
Oh, yeah. Well, Sparta fans were pretty intense, weren't they?
They were too, yeah.
Yeah. And the ISL league, as you get out of this period, that's the league that kind of stays, right? All these other, the Chicago Soccer League, the CD League, ones that kind of grew out of Peel's structure, original structure, the ISL is the kind of one that maintains.
What's so interesting to me about that is most of the original founding leagues were from the early British and Scottish immigrants and Irish folk. And then the outsiders, who were all these other ethnic groups, formed their own leagues where the teams were one ethnic group and a team. But it was International Soccer League and it was called that because it was a team of Czechs and it was a team of Danish people and a team of fill in the blank, just not British people. Mm-hmm. Right?
From the fill in the blank islands. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah.
Beautiful this time of year.
Yeah.
So, but they're the ones who prevail in terms of a league that sustains itself
in some form
and sustains changes and is absorbing kind of all of the teams that fall off of these other leagues that are struggling to maintain themselves.
And really all the way up to the NASL, like decades later. Yeah. So those are the three kind of key teams. So you had early Pullman carrying on, Bricklayers kind of picked up till the Depression kind of killed them. And then Sparta.
We forgot to mention Sparta's the first Chicago team that captured a U.S. Open Cup.
That's right.
We forgot to mention that little fact.
Well, we're mentioning it
now. Okay. Well, they
which was a big deal.
It was a huge deal.
Yeah.
Because it was always an Eastern team that won. And Sparta did it first. And then they were dethroned 1 year by a mob-sponsored team. Mm-hmm. The Manhattan Brewers.
Yes.
Somehow a Chicago team sponsored by the mob. Let's not forget.
Yeah. Run by Al Capone's accountant.
Yes. And then Sparta came back because the mob was like, oh, this isn't working out.
We're just going to do 1 year.
They didn't end up winning, but they made the finals.
Well, because they named it wrong. Wasn't it called the Manhattan Brewing Company?
Or, yeah.
Yeah.
And they
Manhattan Brewers.
Yeah. And they managed to have like a monopoly on beer in the city.
Oh. Must have just been through good marketing.
Yeah. Great marketing. But they made the Open Cup final. They didn't win. And they're like, oh, this didn't work out.
Yeah, I guess we'll have to clean our money some other way. And so Sparta got it back.
So, and then the next year, Sparta was on top again.
This is the crest of Sparta.
Yeah, this is the apparent crest of Sparta, ABA. Mm-hmm.
You see their championships in 1938, 1940.
Uh-huh.
That's the Open Cup championships.
Mm-hmm. Except for they were co-champions in 40.
That's why it says co-champs.
Yeah, this is kind of gorgeous.
It's classic.
Yeah.
And that center image very much reminds me of the kind of Chicago Public Library crest. Have you ever seen that?
I'm sure I have, but yeah. I don't.
It's similar to that.
Yeah.
Well, that's awesome.
Yeah.
That's great. But there were other things going on in the development of the sport. This is the period when this city is really growing, mm-hmm. blowing up, and that's at all levels. So what were some of the other ways in which the sport was growing?
In spite of what people may think up to this day, there mm-hmm. is a world outside of adult men's leagues.
Oh, what?
Yeah, it's true. Yep. So city parks incubated diverse teams of youth players mm-hmm. and the parks and some of the corporations in the area sponsored women's teams as well. So some of the academic teams playing today were founded all the way at the beginning of the 20th century, mm-hmm. making them some of the oldest operating teams in the country. And however unpredictable or unstable the semi-pro and professional leagues got in Chicago, Chicago's parks and schools remain a steady source of soccer enthusiasm for the region.
That's really important because when you think about there's an odd fact about the U.S. soccer pyramid for a long time is that a big chunk of the middle is held up by college teams mm-hmm. that are fed by high school teams because of kind of the success and growth of college and high school and school sports. Soccer was folded into that so that it's a unique kind of infrastructure that doesn't exist in other countries. So that's why to this day you have players from around the world who maybe fell out of their academies back home, try to get back into it through the U.S. academic system. So I think that's tied into how it started to develop in these areas. You mentioned, we'll come back to that side, but you said the academic side.
Yeah.
I want to mention only because we are in Oak Park.
Yes.
And Oak Park River Forest High School, they are one of the first two high school teams to schools to field teams in the city, probably the state. We've been trying to verify that, but I'm pretty sure this day as well. The other high school, Englewood, closed in 2008. There's now a charter school there, but it's a different organization. So that makes them actually the oldest high school organized soccer team.
That's still operating.
But when you think about the year that happened, which I think is 1906, they potentially are one of the longest continually operating teams in the state and the city. And their team is actually still very good. They were ranked number one in the state last year. And it was actually their only loss came in an overtime loss in the regional finals. And ironically, the first ever coach of that team was their math teacher and their current coach. Also the
is
math
that
teacher.
Same math teacher.
Yeah, another. And they have a connection with Peel too, because Peel also sponsored a shield trophy.
Mm-hmm. Mini.
Yeah. Peel for Cup. A competition between Suburban and Chicago City clubs, right?
Yeah. It was the
Peel
big,
shield.
The big high school competition was the Peel shield.
Yeah. Well, big for just a few couple of years because what happened?
Because Oak Park. Why'd you have to do this? So Oak Park, was it Oak Park and Englewood were finalists for the Peel Shield, and they ended up having a co-win. Mm. co-champions. And then the next year, Oak Park made it to the finals again. And they were like, we're not competing for the Peel Shield. And so then the Peel Shield just ended.
Yeah. This picture is from later than that. This is mid 20th century, but I do like the classic style kits they have. Ugh, not at all what they
so
have now.
So nice.
And then this is a picture of not a Chicago team, but in honor of really the existence and kind of contradiction surrounding the women's game mm-hmm. at the time. This is the Dick Kerr Lady Kickers. This is a British club. In England, there was starting to be the development of women's soccer. And until the FA decided that it was their right and duty to outlaw it. So Dick Kerr's team did not stop playing, but instead hit the road, and they toured extensively around the world and in the US. And they were quite a talented side and also very, very, very cool kits.
I want them to bring these hats back.
Oh, yeah.
I think that Real Salt Lake and LA could have used some hats
used
while they were playing
this last weekend. Well, what's crazy too is that the FA in England, it was illegal to have organized women's soccer up until 1970 or 71.
Just about the time when women could get credit cards too.
Oh, yeah. Man. It's just ridiculous. But, and also this is the inspiration of the Footy Museum imagined women's team from the era.
Yeah.
But the rules also reflected a lot of the sexism of the time for the women's game.
So there were a couple different versions of the women's game in Chicago. Mm-hmm. There was kind of these like, let's have a women's team and they'll come and play in their skirts and their pantaloons mm-hmm. And we're not going to we're going to have our side and their side, but we're going to mix the group so that they don't get too
competitive.
Can't get too competitive. Mm-hmm. It's too masculine a trait. And at halftime, so that we can calm everybody down, we'll serve mm-hmm. tea.
And the trowels that they stabbed each other with had doilies around them.
Yes, they were bedazzled.
And you had to ask permission. May I please trowel you?
And then they would stab each other and they'd giggle and apologize.
I bury my pain.
Which is not too far off. There's a newspaper reporting of one of these matches where it like would describe their appearance and their weight and all this stuff. And be like they were just giggling and apologizing if they knocked each other over. But then there were a couple properly outfitted teams. Mm-hmm. It was from Western Electric Company.
Again, not far from here.
Uh-huh. And Sparta. So they had a Sparta women's side and Western Electric, and those seemed to be properly outfitted, properly competitive teams for the most part.
And I also wanted to mention an historic landmark that wove itself throughout this history. Opened in 1924, so this is the 100th anniversary of Soldier Field in Chicago. A Soldier Field where you were last night to watch a soccer match, the Chicago Fire. And I don't remember what the score was for historic.
Neither do I, because I had two beers, so I was pretty, pretty sloshed.
So contemporary Americans think Soldier Field was built for, always was, and it's just tied in with Chicago Bears. The Bears did not move there until the 70s, I believe.
Bears, never heard of them.
Yeah. But from the beginning, this was a site of many important football matches, soccer matches, mm-hmm. including numerous U.S. Open Cups. And mm-hmm. I think it points to really this hidden history of the sport, not just in Chicago, but the country. And somehow, and it's happening again with MLS, right? They don't want the risks of participating in the U.S. Open Cup, and they're happy to let that die and rebuild something new that they completely control, just mm-hmm. like the NASL did, just like different leagues before did. And the problem with that is there's so many problems, but one aspect historically that happens is that then fans think that that is actually the history, and they're not even aware of places like where maybe their team plays, like Soldier Field, the importance of it in the development of the sport in the country, or the fact that maybe two blocks from their house, Rangers visited 100 years ago to play a local team. And why is that important? Why is that not? It's always good to know the true history, but if we're talking about making connections, and again, the sport is about we're using sport as this lens to have a broader connection to where we live, to each other, and a broader perspective. To really get a sense of that, you have to understand that history. If you don't know that, everything is just kind of outside of you. You're not woven into it. And your kind of role in the development of society is kind of ignored for kind of corporate products, right?
Yeah.
And it also is it's the history of sport reminds us that these sports and teams were not created to make billions of dollars for nation-owned corporations.
No.
It was about sport. It was about community, even though sometimes it was violent and awful, and we can talk more about that in a second. But it was about the where you lived, representing it, and having fair competition, and really the essence of sport. Yeah. And that's at its base. And that's, we continue to stray from that. And the less we know about that history, the easier it is to stray from it. So,
yeah. Wonderfully said.
Thank you. But this period of time from 1910 to 1930 also saw a lot of challenges that highlighted bigger issues in the country. Mentioned, but I don't think we're going to talk about the impact, but the 1919 Spanish flu coming off the tail end of World War I.
Yeah.
So soldiers coming back from the war also brought back this very deadly flu. And everyone who remembers COVID and kind of quarantining.
COVID, what's that?
And the fear and anxiety around that. The Spanish flu killed many more people through its different waves. And just like during COVID, leagues were suspended or couldn't play. And also in that period, that same year, there was a lot of tensions that existed in Chicago that were being reflected across the country as well. So one thing that was also happening is the first waves of workers at all these industries at places like Pullman were British, Irish workers. And then we got groups like from Czechoslovakia, Germany. But then also what started to happen was the great migration of Black Americans from the South to take jobs at factories and better their lives in the North. And Chicago saw an explosion of the Black population, which is really at the center of so much of the creativity and identity of the city mm-hmm. today. But if you think about at that time, these neighborhoods, we talked about the intensity of the following of these ethnic clubs.
Yeah.
That really spilled over into their identity of their neighborhoods as well. And it always didn't always manifest in a kind of a beautiful, heroic way at all. There was tensions between the groups, and then a lot of the groups looked at Black Americans moving up, sometimes taking jobs at factories for maybe less pay than what was being paid to previous groups, very much viewed as outsiders coming into the community. There was simmering tension. You throw into that a period of war, then the Spanish flu, and in the summer of 1919 in July, there was one incident where a young Black man was swimming in what was designated a whites-only swimming area, which is crazy. That's one lake. and a white Chicago citizen started throwing stones and stoned him to death. Now, because there was this larger Black population now, there were groups that gathered to protest this death, rightfully so. But that led to other groups, sometimes even groups of supporters of football teams like the mm-hmm. Hibernians or other groups that then clashed with the Black Chicagoans. And it led to a 13-day period of lawlessness, part of the Red Summer, where these incidents, racial incidents happened across the country. Chicago was one of the worst. I think that over 300 people were injured. I forget the number. Was it 37 died? 37 to 50 people died. And over 1,000 Black families were left homeless because their homes were destroyed. And you can see on the upper right here is a picture from the back of the Yards neighborhood of just a devastated building. And on the bottom, you see the Illinois State Infantry, which would now be like, I guess,
the National Guard.
The National Guard on the streets with an old tank. And I'm going to guess they were maybe leaning towards protecting one side over the other in this conflict.
You don't say.
But also tied in is you had soldiers, Black soldiers, who had gone off and fought to represent the country in World War I, something that repeated World War II, came back and were treated again as not even full citizens. So that was simmering, and that's more of the kind of picture we see at the top. So that was also happening in the city at the time. Yeah. And those are things that have repeated in the history of the city and also the country. And I think it's important to mention in this context, because we are in a way glorifying these past teams,
yeah,
because there is a history of a sport we enjoy, and it's a history of the city that we still see echoed in the city. So it's part of our history. But the same sort of tensions and violence that has coursed through the history of the city and the country also coursed through those clubs.
Yeah. I mean, it's important to mention, like, the league was structured mm-hmm. by distinct ethnic groups forming teams separate from one another, which is something nobody would stand for now.
No.
Right?
I mean, that's insane. Yeah.
I feel like it goes without saying, but let's just say it.
So it's a complicated history.
You don't say.
Like all histories. But it is fascinating. And again, there's so many, you know, when we talk about these early Chicago leagues that Peel's involved in, they, you know, 30 plus teams, four levels. There are so many other teams that went through, came out in this period that we did not cover, but they all kind of fell into the categories that we did and were affected by kind of the broad issues of the time. Thoughts?
Yeah. I just, as a like microcosm for the state of football in the U.S. today, there are certain things that still ring true to me. Like in his book about this, Gabe Logan pointed to the importing of international talent mm-hmm. as a detriment to fostering and growing native talent with...
Inner Miami.
Yeah, like, oh, well, yeah. Like, MLS is a development league versus a retirement league. Like, this is the question that we pose often in here.
Well, and also the history of soccer in this country is competing leagues and people trying to monetize as much as possible. Mm-hmm. And this and that cycle continues to this day. And so it's almost like that is really part of our history as well, as is like the turbulent structure that changes. And if you really think about it, it's like so how it was developing in Chicago was the same as how it developed in London, all these other parts mm-hmm. of the world, or in England. But then you add the idea that somehow this all has to be governed in a national scale.
Yeah.
And the scale and diversity of this country also gives some points to it, because if allowed to develop and continue the way that they were going, St. Louis, Chicago, New York, Philadelphia would have as many established clubs as London
exactly,
does.
Exactly.
Exactly. Yeah.
I think I was thinking back to teams like when you're talking about Ecuador mm-hmm. in our Ecuador episode and, or Turkey. And it's like, yes,
those are the accurate directions, by the way.
They are actually.
France.
The leagues, these early leagues would start out of the city and then mm-hmm. gradually expand to the whole country. If our early leagues had started in Chicago and expanded out to Illinois, or let's say Illinois, Wisconsin, mm-hmm. and then we have
Midwest League,
just this tiny, tiny, like it's much smaller than the National League, because it's even an Eastern and Western Conference is too big.
Yeah.
It's way too big.
Well, think when your nearest rival, biggest rival, you know, again, the Manchester Derbies today, if your biggest rival was a train ride away, think about the intensity of that. Like, Chicago always gets really behind the Crosstown Classic, the White Sox versus mm-hmm. the Cubs. But imagine if that was multiple.
Yeah.
And there was all sorts of true derbies in the city. And it could have... It's one of those things where just different events or decisions that can seem innocuous at the time really unfold such different futures, you know? So with this, you think, well, if it were not for the Depression, what could have happened? If it were not for the concerted effort to grow baseball versus mm-hmm. these other sports, what may have happened? If Peel grew a beard, what would have happened?
I like his mustache.
You know?
He looked like Hercule Poirot.
But anyway, so that's it.
I digress.
For today. We will be picking up I want to say another month. It takes some time, but we will be jumping into the mid to later 20th century and see how the sport continues to grow during a period which I don't know as much about. So I'm looking forward to kind of that, you know, 30s through 50s period and what happened, because there was also obviously major changes in the globe and society. And I also feel like maybe that's the period where we start to see why soccer fell behind these other sports. Either way, that's the story of football. And thank you for joining us. And make sure to follow us on all the socials at The Footy Museum. You can check out our website, thefootymuseum.com. We have a great shop with wonderful logos from all the full history. Read our history.
Yeah.
Which is a creative history, but based very much on the real histories that we tell through this podcast and through our exhibitions launching this month in March. So thank you so much.
Thank you.
It's been very appealing speaking with you.
Chicago history makes my heart go peter patter.
We have to end this podcast because I have to go peel.
All right.
All right. Goodbye.
Goodbye.